Okay, Proverbs 15. We left off with verse 15, but I actually want to go back and look at 14 and 15 again just to kind of get us back into the context here. So Proverbs 15, verse 14. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. So back in 14, the heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge. And we talked about this last time, and I think it was Donna that used the example of it's like an upward spiral. The one who has some understanding, what does he do? Give me more. I want more. So the one who has some wisdom, who is wise in some respects, seeks more wisdom. So what ultimately happens to him? He gets wiser and wiser and wiser. And then you've got the flip side of that. But the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. Rather than building themselves up on wisdom, they chase after gossip and drama and all of these foolish things that don't make them stronger, that just cause them to spiral downward. So you've got the opposite effect going on there. Verse 15, all the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. Mark your places and turn to Philippians 4. Thinking about a merry heart, I was going to make some points from this. Let's just read the whole section. Philippians 4, starting in verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. Now at your last care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So just kind of going, and let's go back to Proverbs, tying that in with the idea, he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. In what sense is all of that we read that Paul talks about and what's being made here, in what sense is it a continual feast?
If you're glad in your heart and you're glad where you are at that particular point in your life, it's a feast. It's a happy place. You know, you do a happy dance all the time.
Notice how Paul made mention. He said, "You know, I know how to be abased. I know how to abound, but I've learned wherever I am, whatever state I'm in, I'll be content." So he's able to find happiness. He's able to find that joy. And of course, earlier there in Philippians 4, he started out the whole thing with rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. As Christians, we should be joyful people. And we talked about this last week, and it's certainly worth mentioning again. What a travesty it is if you have someone washed in the blood of Christ and they're just miserable to be around and they drag people down with them. What an absolute nightmare that is. For a lot of reasons, what is our purpose as Christians as far as our purpose with God's Word? What are we to do with it?
Fear God and keep His commandments.
Okay. We're to live it, respect it, teach it to others, fear God and keep His commandments. How effective am I going to be teaching God's Word to other people if I am miserable all the time? Why would they want to hear anything I have to say? Because apparently it's not working very well in my life. Why would they want it in theirs? But what about the flip side? If you have someone who is joyful and they're constantly rejoicing and they're just the kind of person that you're around and you think, how can they be so happy with all of the stuff going on. The bad things are happening in their life and they still are joyful. Does it make you wonder why? And it makes me wonder, how can they do it? And if the answer is, this is why. Because I know who my Lord is. And because I know the promises that He's made to me. Now you can teach somebody if you have that kind of attitude. It's certainly easier. It brings up a lot more opportunities than the other. And going back to what Donna said, just for your own self. Being miserable all the time stinks. It's not good for you health-wise. It's not good for you spiritually. It's not good for your family. But that joy is certainly something that it does good to all around you. So, great admonition here. Any thoughts on 14 or 15 before we move through? Bob?
But we have to remember that if we're not happy, evidently we're sad. And that's because Satan wants us to be sad. He wants to think that we're missing out on something when we're really not.
Yeah. And I do want to be fair. Are there times when we should be sad? I mean, certainly there are. I'm not saying we should just be bubbling and all the time ridiculous and ignoring hardships. But the thing is, even in bad times, can Christians find joy? Can they find something to rejoice about? I certainly hope we can. We should be able to. But good point, Bob. Yeah.
It's an occasional thing when somebody has a tragedy or a loss or something. They're sad for a period of time. But the people that are joyful the majority of the time, they're like a magnet and it draws you to them. Yeah. And on the other hand, the people that you know that everything you say to them, they're going to have something negative to say about it or how bad their day was, you kind of stay away from them. And, there's a time to mourn, there's a time to laugh. Scripture says that. Yeah. But it's not a continual time. It's a specific time. But these other times are the majority of the time that a person either draws people to them or people shun away from them.
Yeah. Do you know the people who are continually negative? And then when they walk up and are about to say something, what's the first thing that goes through your mind?
Oh, boy.
Just take a deep breath. Here it comes. Yeah, and you love them. Yeah, I'm not saying that you don't. But in all honesty, if someone is always negative, always bringing up the bad, and no matter what bad has happened to you, it cannot possibly be as bad as what's happened to me because my life is the worst ever. You just kind of take a deep breath and say, all right, here we go. Here comes a storm. Let me weather it because here it comes. And that's not good. That's not a good effect to have on others. Donna, you had a comment.
No, I was just going to say that to say something, what you said, you will have bad times. But you have solace in God. You know that He is there for you.
Yeah.
And it will pass, whatever the sad times are.
Absolutely. Good. Okay, well, let's put 16 and 17 with it. We'll move on from there. Verse 16, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. So better to be without material wealth and be a servant of the Lord than to be physically rich and yet be without Him. And then 17, better is a dinner of herbs where love is. It'd be better to eat a salad with somebody who loves you than have a steak dinner where there's hatred and strife and all of these troubles. If you flip over a chapter, so Proverbs 17, verse 1, also gives the idea of the very best things in this life money cannot buy. Better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. Same idea, really, that we're talking about here. Can you put a price on quietness? And that's not necessarily total silence. What is being talked about with quietness? What is that?
Peace.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's peace. There can be words being spoken, but it's not strife. It's not constantly troubled. It's peace. Think about the blessing it is to sit around a table with people you love, friends, family, brethren, and just enjoy it. No arguing, no strife, no troubles, just being able to enjoy each other's presence. It is no surprise to me, and all of us have, certainly we've shared meals with family and with brethren. You know what it's like. You know that incredible bond. It's no surprise to me that we see in the New Testament, when someone falls away, What is the admonition given about sharing a meal with them?
Nothing.
Yeah. That's powerful. Because what does the ability for you and me to sit down and share a meal together, what's it like? As family, as brethren, what is that?
It's uplifting.
It's encouraging. It's everything good. And in a sense, you can kind of, around brethren, you can kind of let your guard down. I mean, I know we always put the armor on, but around brethren, I don't worry about them coming in bringing stuff. You know, there are certain things. I don't worry about them using foul language and having to deal with that issue. I don't worry about all of these. I can just enjoy the presence and the conversation. For that to be taken away, does it make a powerful point? And I think that's the point, is to show that this relationship, because if I've fallen away from the Lord, my relationship with God has been severed. And that not sharing that special bond of a meal shows that relationship, it's a physical way of showing that it's been severed. Very, very powerful impact that it makes. Notice in 17, what is the emphasis in 17? Is it the food? It's not food. Food is secondary. What is the emphasis?
Love, brotherly love.
Yeah, the emphasis is love. This is the whole thing. It's put against the idea of hatred. Even when you've got all the good physical things, with hatred, it's miserable. Who wants to sit at that table, even though the food is great? Good. Let's put 18 with the here. A wrathful man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention. Strife doesn't easily come to someone who is good at controlling his temper. He considers a matter before he responds to it. A lot of times people who are quick to lose their temper, what excuses are normally given?
It's just the way I am.
That's it. It's just the way I am. It runs in my family. It runs in my family. And so what, in saying that, what is he expecting you to do? Just accept it. Yeah, it runs in my family, so you need to accept the fact that I lose my mind whenever anything happens. You need to accept that, because that's just the way it is. It suggests that self-control is not something under my control. It suggests that maybe genetics have made it so that self-control is not possible. Is that true? No. See, we can control ourselves, and we're commanded to in multiple places. Self-control can keep trouble from being stirred up in a lot of ways. Look back at verse 1 of this chapter. Chapter 15, verse 1, a soft answer turns away wrath, a harsh word stirs up anger. So having that self-control can keep a lot of other problems from cropping up. How does a hot-tempered man typically act? He makes sure that. Go ahead.
He's out of control most of the time.
Yeah, he carefully considers all the facts before he moves. Right?
No,
he doesn't. He listens to very little. He may have little of what's actually going on, and he stirs up a lot of trouble in the process because of that. Marketplaces. Turn to James 1. James 1, if someone will read verses 19 and 20 for us.
So then, my brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God.
Man's wrath and God's righteousness are often at odds with each other. And something I need to keep in mind. Good. Any other thoughts on this idea of self-control or the wrathful man being slow to anger? Brian?
I deal with that situation every day in my job, and hot-tempered people, and they have a little problem controlling their temper. in a work situation. I don't know what happens when we come to church and our guards are down or whatever. We don't have to answer to somebody, and that's probably the reason that you get some hot temper people in church that at work they would control their temper, but at church, not so much.
That is a prime example that we can control it when we want to. We absolutely can. This was a month ago. We walked in to Zaxby's, and Sasha was about to sit down with the girls, and I heard the guy sitting next to us. I heard what they were saying, the language they were using. I said, let's just go sit over here, because I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want the girls to hear it. But as I was walking off, I heard one of the guys say, you know, I can't control my mouth. I mean, I can't control it. I mean, you know, that's why I cuss like that, because I just can't. And I was thinking, do you think, it was a lot more colorful than what I just gave you. He had a lot more adjectives and things in there. But do you think the first time he went to meet his girlfriend's parents, he used that language?
No.
I have a hard time believing that he did. So what does that mean? He can control it when he wants to. He can control it when he knows he needs to, when it's important. But he just doesn't make a habit of it. So it is something that we can have control over.
Anybody would use that kind of language when they go for a job interview?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Going back to what Brian said, when you tell yourself it's really important, well, now I can keep it under wraps and I can control my temper and my language or whatever it is. But, yeah, we tell ourselves we can. Good. Any other thoughts on that?
Seems like we're living in a world where we're not willing to take responsibility or own our own mistakes, so therefore we don't work on them because we don't have any control over someone else's fault, so we never get better at them.
Yeah. Why should I work on it when I can just blame somebody else? That's absolutely. Go ahead, Bob.
But, you know, if a person just stopped to think about, if I don't control my temper, there's consequences down the road.
Yeah.
I was listening at noon this morning, and some people told this fella that there was some alligators in this stream, and he used profanity and jumped in the stream anyway, and the alligator killed him.
Go back to verse 14. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. The actions of fools feeds on foolishness too. Right? They don't listen to the wisdom that's offered to them, and they just kind of jump headlong, literally in that case, jump headlong into things without considering. We see, you know, you think of the fact that Solomon wrote the majority of the Proverbs. We're thousands of years have passed. Has anything changed? As far as man's behavior and his mindset, these things are just as applicable today as they were when Solomon penned them. Good. Yeah, Bill.
Well, there's one thing that has changed. There's now more avenues for you to express your foolishness.
Yeah.
Like online and social media.
Yeah, it is. We have more opportunities to do it. And that's the sad thing. Is the internet good or evil? It's the internet, right? Has good been done over the internet? Bible classes have been taught. People have heard the gospel and obeyed it because of what they've learned over the internet. Good has been done. Has bad been done over the internet? A whole bunch of that has happened. And so it's a tool just like so many other things that can be used for good, that can be used for evil, and certainly it gives a lot of opportunities for the evil. Okay, let's look at 19. The way of a lazy man is like a hedge of thorns, but the way of the upright is a highway. If I am lazy, I will always be able to find an excuse. No doubt. There will always be an excuse. There will always be a hedge of thorns that I can say got in the way. And that's kind of what I take when I read this. You know I was supposed to be there, but I ran into this hedge of thorns and I just couldn't get around it. So I just went home. What is the second half of that? The way of the upright, the righteous. What is their path like?
No obstacle.
Yeah, it's a highway or no obstacle. Now, let's talk about that. being righteous means that you're never going to have any obstacles get in your way? Now, that's not what it's saying. What is the point?
You'll make your way.
Yeah. You won't let whatever obstacle gets there stop you. That's the problem with the lazy man. The reason he can always find an obstacle is because he doesn't want to go anyway. He doesn't want to be wherever he's supposed to be, where the work is to be done. So he'll find an excuse. Makes mountains out of molehills. The righteous man, he knows it's right. He knows it needs to be done. So what's he going to do? Whatever it takes. He is going to make a way. Anyway, he knows the Lord will make a way. And he's going to do what he needs to do, his part, to do what's right. And so, again, you have that opposite mindset between them. Turn to Numbers 13. We're going to talk about this more in the lesson. So I don't want to completely exhaust the chapter, but it's just such a good example. It's an example of the upright not letting excuses get in the way. Even when there are excuses that could easily be used, they refuse to let those things get in the way. Numbers 13, just to set the context, Israel is at the southern border of Canaan. They are about to go in, and God tells Moses, send 12 spies into the land. Let them go in and check it out, see what it's like, see what the people are like. Are they strong or are they weak? Are they many? Are they few? See what their cities are like. Do they live in tents or do they live in fortresses? Let us know. Let us know if there are forests there. So they go in for 40 days. They check it out and they find out the land is good. It is everything God promised them. But they also find out some other things in the land. Number 26, verse 26. Now they departed, came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran in Kadesh. They brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. If you remember, they're carrying grapes on a pole in between two men because they're just so fruitful. Verse 28, nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, which are giants. The Amalekites dwell in the south. The Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites dwell in the mountains. The Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Apparently, after all of that, the people are just kind of, it's just an uproar. And they can't even be heard because Caleb, verse 30, has to quiet them down before he can even talk. Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. You see the difference in attitudes between them? The land is great, but there are really strong people in there. They're stronger than us. They have huge fortresses. They're so much better equipped than we thought. And there are giants in the land. Now, just looking at the excuses, do those sound pretty good? If you're looking for an excuse, would those work? When you bring up giants, I'm done. If I'm looking for an excuse. What does Caleb say? What are we waiting on? Let's go. We are well able to take it. It's a completely different attitude between the upright, the righteous, and then the unrighteous. In this case, those who are afraid. They don't trust the Lord. They're not willing to go in. Bill.
I was just going to point out there were two groups. There were two different mindsets when they faced Goliath, and I'm sure they remember that. They're remembering the bad side of it instead of the attitude of David that went out. They're remembering the attitude of all those that were afraid to go out, even show their face. So.
You know, and just one thing to keep in mind, it hasn't been very long since these people were in Egypt. What did they see in Egypt before they came out?
Army in the time.
Yeah. How did that work out for Pharaoh's army when he chased them? He ended up at the bottom of the Red Sea, right? That's what they've seen. They have seen the firstborn die. They have seen animals killed. They have seen hailstones coming out big enough to kill people. They have seen water turn to blood. They have seen all of these things. And yet out of 12 spies, 10 of them say, we need to quit. Just leave it alone. We can't do it. We are like grasshoppers in the sight of these people. And then you've got the opposite of that. Joshua and Caleb say, these people are bread. They are like our bread. We can just eat them up. If God is with us, this is not a problem. Again, the difference between the attitude of the upright and those who don't trust the Lord. And again, I don't want to exhaust it anymore. We're going to talk about that, Lord willing, the next hour. But any thoughts before we move on?
Bye. They had seen slavery too.
Yeah.
And they soon forgot it. We've seen sin. Once we get out of it, we shouldn't want to go back.
It is hard for me to read Numbers 14, verse 4, without just throwing my hands up and rolling my eyes. So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. Because that was so good, right? Now, you remember the hardships that we see at the beginning of Exodus that the Pharaoh of that day is putting on him. He doesn't remember Joseph. He doesn't remember the good that the Israelite people have brought on Egypt. He doesn't care. He's scared of them and wants to just put them down as much as possible. He lays all of these burdens on them, and yet they say, as soon as things don't go the way they want, let's go back. We need to go back to Egypt because it was so great there. It just... unbelievable. But before we get too mad at them, do you do it? Do I do it? Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes our vision gets clouded too. We start thinking back, well, you know the way things used to be. And we can deceive ourselves too. They certainly did. Matt.
Well, I think you're kind of starting to hit on it. Not a spiritual application for us as Christians, but verse 19 in Proverbs about the way the sluggard being lazy. And I think a lot of us have done it at some point in time in our Christian lives of making up excuses to not go to the assembly, whether it's Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, or gospel meetings, or reading our Bibles, studying. We will, well, I'm going to be 10 minutes late, there's no reason to go now. Or gospel meetings of, oh, I've had a long day at work, and it starts in 30 minutes, I'm just too worn out, or my head hurts a little bit. And we throw up all these excuses of why we shouldn't go, or why we shouldn't do this or something, related to our local body and being present at assemblies or Bible studies or whatever. And we do the same things. I think a lot of us have at some point in time in our lives. So it's a good example and lesson for us on not letting the hedges of thorns get in our way, and which is just the devil, acting on us to not do spiritual things.
That's good. And it certainly affects us individually when we don't put forth that effort. Does it affect anybody else?
Yeah.
It affects everybody else. And you've seen examples, just like I have, of someone getting off work late and maybe coming to services on a Wednesday night or a Sunday night. They are dirty from work and they're hot, and they walk in and they sit in the back because they don't want to draw any attention, and they might catch the last 15 minutes. You ever been mad at anybody for doing that? Have you ever said, man, I can't believe he came up in here dressed like that wanting to hear 15 minutes of Bible teaching? What's his problem? Who's ever said that? And yet, have you ever had Satan tempt you to, well, you're not going to be on time and you might upset some people, so you probably should just skip altogether? Unfortunately, we probably follow that more than the other one. But what happens, we talked about the effect for us, the building up. What happens to your brethren when you walk in, even though you had something, something came up, the car broke down, whatever it is, and you still get there, even if it's late? What effect does it have? It is encouraging. It builds them up because it shows how badly you wanted to be there. We had a gospel meeting. It was back in the spring. Our friend Ty from Auburn, he was driving up to come to the meeting. We were excited to see him. Ty walked in when the invitation song was being led. There was a wreck on I-85, and so he was just sitting there the whole time. And when he got here, there were 5 minutes left. Did it encourage you anyway? He tried. He did everything. He wanted to be here. And yet he was still an encouragement. So, don't ever let Satan talk us out of that. Good point, Matt. Good. Let's look at 20 and 21. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. Folly is joy to him who is destitute of discernment, but a man of understanding walks uprightly. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. How do you feel when you see your children acting wisely, especially in spiritual things? How do you feel? Yeah. I mean, it warms your heart. It is great. And even with the little ones, when you see them learning and doing things that are good things, it just, I mean, your heart swells so good. What about the children who don't? Show no interest in godly things, show foolish, worldly decisions all the time. How does that make you feel? Just the exact opposite. Just like a hole in you to see that, to see the waste going on. It says that they despise their mother because the actions she taught them, they're going against all of those things. It's just heartbreaking. Putting the next verse with it, chasing after folly among the foolish, it's fun. It seems like a good time. Chasing after sin seems like a good time. They ignore truth and eternity. But the wise man understands there's a lot more. There's a lot more to life than just the things that we have here and see in front of us. Good. Any comments on either of those two? Matt?
Verse 20, I think, talking about the foolish man despising his mother, I think the other side of that might be that, you know, we all always know that deep down we have a sense of being with our Creator. And even if you're the most wayward, that there's always this yearning of something better, and that's why worldly people chase after wealth, because they're wanting something that they can't attain. And it's spiritual what it is, because we have a yearning to be back to the Father that created us. And sometimes I think the foolish man despises his mother is not because she or even the father trying to teach spiritual things and they despise them. But, and maybe you were implying this and I didn't understand, but despise them because they have a yearning for wanting something that's spiritual. And a lot of times the parents weren't the example that they should have been to their kids on spiritual things. And they end up despising them, even though it may be indirect and not come to fruition of knowing exactly why, but despising them for not actually being that example that they needed in life, a spiritual example.
And teaching them what they should have.
Right.
Yeah, that could be true as well. Yeah. Okay, 22. Without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. Now, I think we have to... This is talking about godly counsel, because you can receive some bad counsel. That certainly happens. This idea here is when good counsel, wise counsel, godly counsel is given. Without godly counsel, will plans go awry? Every time. Every time. But in the multitude of counselors, again, godly counselors, they are established. So, who are your counselors? I mean, I'm not asking for an answer necessarily, but I mean, this is something we're going to have to answer individually. Who are my counselors? Who are those that I look to give me wisdom? Because that's going to determine the kind of answer I get. And I think he comes to everybody's mind when you read a verse like this is Rehoboam, right? Solomon's son. He was to be king over the entire nation. He had an opportunity to choose his counselors. He could have chosen the older men, the elders, the wiser men that his father had, which were offering him good counsel. Counsel that would have made the people love him like crazy if he had just gone through with it. And then he had the counsel of his friends, the young men that he had grown up with, who basically tell him, you be even harsher than your father ever was. You show him what a man you are. Well, which counsel did he choose? Chose the younger men. And when I say younger men, I always think in my mind, I kind of picture it as him being 19 or 20. He's like 41. So he should have known better anyway. And his friends should have known better. But they were fools. You go back to this verse. If you want to be a fool, you can be it till you're 89, 90, 105. Age doesn't necessarily cure that. It should, but it doesn't. A lot of times it doesn't. So Rehoboam chooses that way. What happened to him?
His
kingdom splits and he loses those tribes that go end up going with Jeroboam. So certainly we've got an example we can use there. 23, a man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. The way of life winds upward for the wise, that he may turn away from hell below. Let's look at these two together, and then we'll probably be out of time. A man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. What is a word spoken in due season? What does it mean?
Encouragement when an encouragement is due. And it could be this, just the opposite, when it's when someone needs to be talked about for doing things that are wrong in the proper time and in the proper way.
I also see the idea in Proverbs, a word fitly spoken. And same idea here. When it's needed, that's when it's spoken. It may be a rebuke, maybe encouragement, whatever the case is. When it's needed, that's the word that is given. Verse 24, the way of life winds upward for the wise. Kind of going back to a verse we looked at earlier, that he may turn away from hell below. So again, you've got... Yeah, it's amazing. A lot of times, Old Testament and New, the idea of a path laid before you is described. Jesus certainly shows us that in Matthew 7 as well. Here, you've got a path that winds upward. It's constantly going upward. That idea of a heavenly path, a righteous path, versus the path that's going below. It's spiraling downward, as we mentioned earlier, which leads to hell. When we fill with godly wisdom, where does it set our path? Which direction? It's the heavenly one, the upward. And when we ignore godly wisdom, it sets our path on hell. So certainly this comparison, very clear there. Okay, we do have a few more minutes. Let's look at 25 and 26. The Lord will destroy the house of the proud, but he will establish the boundary of the widow. The thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord, but the words of the pure are pleasant. How does God feel about pride? Yeah. Go back to chapter 6. Proverbs 6, verse 16. These six things the Lord hates, yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. Verse 17, a proud look is the first thing mentioned there. Why does God hate pride? I mean, we know he does. It's very clear. That verse is clear, and this one as well. We look at tons of others. Why would he hate pride? We can figure out why.
Pride usually depends on
themselves. It is. Pride says, I don't need you, God. Look at what I've accomplished. Look at what I've done. Look how good I am. You know, why should I seek counsel from anywhere else? Because, after all, I got all the counsel I need, Nebuchadnezzar. Right? We've seen that before with people in the Bible who have shown that attitude. The proud man thinks he can direct his own steps, even though Jeremiah tells us that he can't. He thinks that he's self-sufficient. He doesn't need anyone, including the Lord. And going back to the points we've looked at earlier, will the proud man take the counsel of the wise? Not likely. Not unless they just happen to agree with him, because he trusts in his own way. He thinks he's wiser than everyone else anyway. Why would he listen to anyone else? Good. Any thoughts on this? Look at the end of 25. He will establish the boundary of the widow. One thing to keep in mind when we talk about the book of Proverbs, it is a book of general truths. Generally speaking, these things will come to pass. Which is not to say that there's never been a widow who is never did not trust in the Lord. But typically, what would, especially at this time, what would the situation of the widow be like? Is she self-sufficient? She understands the need to depend on the Lord. Certainly, you're talking about a widow in Israel. Would she, if she had any wisdom at all, would she have understood the need to depend on the Lord? She would have. And so you've got a comparison here going between the one in 25, the house of the proud, who depends on himself, and then you've got the widow who understands she's not self-sufficient. She needs that help. And so she depends on the Lord. And certainly her boundary will be established. What does that mean? She'd be taken care of. Yeah, absolutely. And then with 26, the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord. We look back in Proverbs 6, showed us other abominations there, but the words of the pure are pleasant. We'll pick up with that one again, Lord willing, next Sunday. Any last thoughts? Okay, thank you.